Well, howdy there, stranger. I'm Jordy.
And I'm Brad.
And welcome back to Beers with Queers, the true crime podcast where I research a case, and Brad here, and potentially you guys,
don't know a damn thing about it.
So today's case is another example of a serial killer that has, for the most part, been lost to time. He's not as well known as Dahmer or Gacy, but his crimes were just as horrific and occurred around the same time period as Gacy was committing his murders. Except today's killer was active halfway around the world in Glasgow, Scotland. And we are talking about Archibald Hall, aka the Bloody Butler. So, I don't have anything else really to talk about, so let's just jump right into it. It's 1924, and the world was at the height of what would become known as the Roaring Twenties, a new culture of sexual freedom and liberation having swept across the world following the end of World War I, and a new age of prosperity and indulgence had begun with no end in sight. Now, several high-profile criminal cases attempted to shatter this new sense of freedom and reminded the world of the horrors that can happen. Now, the biggest of these cases was, of course, the case of Leopold and Loeb, whom we covered just a few episodes ago if you guys haven't heard about that case. The details of what they did and why they did it sent shockwaves all throughout the world as many began to question the way children were being raised and acting during this time period. But while the world had their eyes fixed on Chicago and the trial of these two sadistic killers, thousands of miles away in the small neighborhood of McLean Street in Glasgow, Scotland, a baby was born on July 17, 1924. The baby was a boy born to Mary and Archibald Hall Sr., and the couple decided to name him Archibald Thompson Hall after his father and grandfather before him. He was perfect, healthy, and happy, and just everything you could want from a baby. But little did his parents, or anyone for that matter, would know, Archie would grow up to become one of the most sadistic serial killers in Scottish and Britain history. So what little we know about Archie's childhood is that his family struggled throughout his early years, with his father working several odd jobs around Glasgow and eventually joining the army for a brief period before being discharged. Now, by all accounts, Archie was a perfectly normal kid whose parents treated him well and showed him love on a daily basis. He wasn't beaten or abused or anything. He was described as being extremely charismatic and outgoing from a very early age, which of course attracted the attention of girls and even women towards him. So he would describe later his first sexual experience occurring with a woman on his 16th birthday in 1940. When he was seduced by a 30-year-old friend of his mother's. So right off the bat, kind of problematic.
Very problematic.
So by the time 1940 rolled around, the world was, of course, in shambles again, as World War II was well underway in Europe, and Archie began to develop a fascination for Hitler. So this fascination eventually led to him secretly collecting Nazi memorabilia and propaganda that he hid in his room. And of course, this is in the midst of World War II, so this does not look good at all to anybody, especially authorities.
Yeah, I mean, while the war's going on, like, to everywhere except the Axis powers, Hitler was, like, the number one bad guy of the world.
Yeah, he was enemy number one of the world, and it would be like someone today collecting, like, you know, terrorist memorabilia or school shooter memorabilia. So one day, several officers conducted a surprise raid on the Hall home, and they confiscated all of Archie's Nazi items. Now, when asked to explain himself, he simply stated that he admired how Hitler was able to stabilize Germany's economy, which I hate to say, but he did stabilize the economy, but that's not a good enough reason to collect Nazi memorabilia. Now, not much honestly came from this, although both Archie and his father were told that they would not be able to enlist in the army. And he suspected for his entire life it was due to fears that he may be a Nazi sympathizer, which, valid point.
Very valid point.
Now, Archie had his first homosexual encounter not long after this, when a young Polish freedom fighter began staying with his family after fleeing to Glasgow to fight against the Nazis. A captain known only as Jakubowski spent several months staying with the family, where he shared a bed and bedroom with the teenage Archie, and it did not take long before the two began to experiment with one another, which eventually turned into a full-blown sexual affair. It was at this point that Archie realized he could have, quote-unquote, the best of both worlds, and he came out to himself as bisexual. Now, the two men spent the summer running around town, dining at the best restaurants, and just enjoying each other's company. It was around this time, when he was 16, that Archie decided that he loved the finer things in life that only seemed to be available to the extremely wealthy. And I think, you know, we all do. And that's the dream. And he later said that, quote-unquote, why should they get all the fun? He told himself that he didn't want to end up poor and with a life full of hardships like his mother and father, and decided that the best way to go about achieving the riches he wanted was to become a jewel thief to support himself.
See, there's the difference. You know, everybody has that aspiration. I want it better. I want to have it better than my family had it. I want to have money. I want to have the finer things. But then there's the people that says, to get there, I'm going to work really hard and I'm going to put forth the effort and I'm going to make something of myself. And then there's the other ones that says, I'm going to become a criminal.
And that's the thing, too, is like a lot of the effort these criminals put into being criminals is like, if you just focused all that on a trade or a skill or a job, you would be president in no time. But the thing is they just don't want to do it. They'd rather just be their own boss by robbing people. So he started off small by setting up two fake Red Cross donation collection tins outside several wealthy businesses, and he pocketed the money he got from it. Now, after that was a success, he moved on to stealing a fancy suit, and he used it to pose as a benefactor for wealthy couples coming from India who were looking to buy up rental properties. So he had this planned out. I mean, he had the whole shtick. I mean, he had the whole shtick set up. You know, wealthy couple from India is coming to look at properties. He's going to go and see if it's right for him. So as he was given tours of potential properties, he would search for any valuable items and steal them to pawn off. Now, his first few theft attempts went off without a hitch and actually netted him a small fortune, which he used to move to London not long after. Now, following his move to London, Archie met and befriended a well-known entertainer at the time named Vic Oliver, and according to Archie, the two began a sexual affair, and pretty soon, Archie was accompanying Vic to lavish sex parties that included wealthy businessmen and well-known celebrities. And it was around this time that Archie took on an assumed name, calling himself Roy Fontaine, a name he came up with after watching actress Joan Fontaine's performance in the Alfred Hitchcock classic Rebecca. So as of right now, I mean, he's achieved his goal. He's wealthy from stealing people, and now he's bumping shoulders with all these celebrities and wealthy businessmen. So he's kind of, you know, made it. And this would be a good point usually to, like, quit while you're ahead. But of course, yeah, he's not going to do that. So Archie's luck would soon run out, and he had his first run-in with the law in 1941 when he was arrested for attempting to sell stolen jewels at a pawn shop, and they called the police. He was given a 2-year suspended sentence, and following that, he began to realize that gay men in the underground London queer scene were very attracted to him, and most would take him back to their flats for sexual encounters. He also knew that due to the stigma and laws at the time, no man would ever report being robbed during a sexual encounter with another man, and thus he got the idea to begin gaining the trust of several men, going back to their flats to have sex, which also gave him a chance to scope out the layout of the flat, look for any valuables. And he would do this a few times before he would finally pounce, knocking the men out with chloroform while robbing them blind. And of course, he was right. They never went to the police. They never reported the robbery. And he got off scot-free.
Because at this time, it was a crime just to be gay. So they would be...
Honestly, they'd probably get a harsher sentence than he would for robbing them. And that's the thing, too, and a lot of these people had families and jobs, and of course, this is a time where if they even suspected you of being gay, they could fire you, and your family would probably disown you. So, of course, it's sad and tragic, but it's understandable why they wouldn't go to the police. And I also wanted to pose a question, like, where the hell do all these people keep getting chloroform? like Leopold and Loeb had chloroform, and a lot of other cases we cover from this time period, a lot of people had chloroform, and it's like just casually carrying it around and I guess stocking it on the shelves. So that's something I've always wondered, is where do people get access to all this chloroform?
I mean, back in the old days, they also had a lot of like access to arsenic. They had, I mean, you could just go down to the drugstore and be like, I have about 20 options of ways to kill somebody that's legal right here on the shelf. So,
and that's fair. It was a pretty lawless land back then, but I just can't imagine people being like, yeah, can I just get a bottle of chloroform? No reason. Yeah.
I mean, there's cocaine and coke. There's all kinds of stuff going on. This was a wild time in history.
That is a fair point. So I guess chloroform's not the weirdest thing to happen back then. So Archie did the successful robberies with gay men multiple times, but pretty soon word spread fast through the London queer community that Archie was not to be trusted by anyone, and pretty soon he had to find a new way to make money. Eventually, he was turned to simply going to wealthy neighborhoods and breaking into homes by smashing out a window. However, of course, this was much riskier, and he was eventually arrested two more times in 1952 and 1954, which landed him close to a year in jail. Now, following his release, Archie took a step back and tried to come up with a better plan to make money because, you know, getting an honest job was simply out of the question. That was the furthest thing from his mind. So he eventually discovered the perfect plan on a visit back to Glasgow to see his parents, discovering that his mother was now working as a maid for a wealthy elderly woman. Now, this inspired Archie and made him realize he too could infiltrate wealthy households by posing as a member of the staff, and it would give him free rein to scope out the house for valuable items, and it would allow him to learn the schedules and routine of the house's occupants and allow him to gain their trust.
I see where the bloody butler is about to come in.
Oh yeah, he makes good of his name, believe me. So using this scheme back in London, Archie was able to forge a fake resume and had several of his friends, who were fellow criminals, pose as past references. Now he got a job as a butler at several wealthy estates to elderly couples, and he quickly used his charm to gain their trust to the point that they treated him like a member of their own family. All the while, he began to pocket and steal various items around the house, taking good care to make sure they wouldn't be noticed by his employers. Now, his plan was working for a time, until during one incident when he was discovered by his employer having sex with her daughter and then promptly fired. So by this point, it's 1956, and Archie is unsatisfied with how much he's making from his pickpocketing of the houses, and he decides to meet up with a friend of his he made in prison named John Wooten. The two had actually begun a relationship while in prison and picked up where they left off once they were reunited on the outside, and John agreed to join Archie in planning a jewel heist. So the two scouted a local London jewelry store, learning when the owners kept the most valuable items and money, and eventually broke in one night and stole nearly $100,000, which today would be $1.1 million, and at the time it was the biggest heist in Britain history. Now, Archie and John were quickly caught, of course, and both were sentenced to 15 years in prison. Archie remained a model prisoner during this time, staying out of trouble, and instead spending his time in his cell studying high society, elocution, and how to better fit in with the wealthy elite. As to the very end of his life, Archie stated he was never sorry for what he did, as he saw stealing from the rich as not a crime in his eyes.
I guess he's like, they've got more than they need.
He essentially is trying to be the Robin Hood, and that's how he justifies it. And so he's like, they have plenty to go around, and they're just being greedy little whores. So I don't feel bad about stealing it.
But Robin Hood took from the rich to give to the poor. He's taking from the rich to give to himself.
But he's like, I am the poor, so you know, it makes sense, you know, it kind of balances out. So in 1964, Archie's father would pass away from a heart attack, and he was actually able to convince the prison to release him on unsupervised leave to attend his funeral, which was granted as long as he promised to return to prison. Now, Archie did attend the funeral, but he didn't return to prison. Instead, he went back to his father's house and ransacked the place for any valuables he could find. He then went on the run, but was quickly caught just a few days later and returned to prison. So that shows you what kind of person he was. He was like, I don't give a crap about my father.
EOS, stealing from his dead father.
Now, Archie was finally paroled in 1972, and he returned to London, and he began working in the kitchen at Whittingham Hospital, which is where he would meet a woman named Mary Coggle, and the two immediately began a sexual relationship, with Mary admitting she was extremely attracted to criminals, which we all have our kinks.
Got a bad boy complex.
Now, around this time, he also met and quickly married a woman named Ruth, but continued his affair with Mary, who didn't seem to mind the arrangement. Archie at first stated that he thought about living a straight and honest life at this point, and he actually did for a time. But soon, the call of possible fortunes to be stolen became too much for him, and he became involved with members of the Communist Party attempting to infiltrate the government and sell secrets to the Soviets. So now Archie has escalated from jewel thief to a communist spy.
Infiltrating the government.
And his plan for the scheme was to try and seduce members of the British Parliament and then blackmail them by threatening to expose their homosexuality if they didn't do as he asked. However, again, this plan did not go so well, and Archie would be returned to prison in 1973 and given another 10-year sentence. After being returned to prison, Archie began an affair with an inmate in the cell beside him with a man named David Wright. They began a passionate relationship and often talked about starting a life together on the outside once they were both released. And during this time, Archie actually called Ruth, his wife, one day in prison and told her that it would be best for both of them if she divorced him since, quote-unquote, he could never love a woman as much as he loved a man. Now, Ruth was heartbroken and followed through with the divorce. However, Mary, his mistress, wasn't swayed, and she agreed to stand by Archie and wait for him, and she didn't mind his relationships with men at all. Which, I mean, if that's what she wants, that's perfectly fine. If they want an open relationship, he is bisexual, perfectly fine, whatever floats your boat, as long as it don't sink mine. Now, Archie remained in prison for 4 years before finally being paroled in 1977, and it was at this point he really did tell himself he was finally going to live an honest life, and he would leave the life of crime behind. He decided to become an honest butler, since by this point he did legitimately work as a butler for several prominent families, and they could all vouch for him, and they did, which allowed him to be hired on as the butler to Lady Margaret Hudson at her manor in, I'm so sorry if I butchered this, Dunfermshire. Now, for several months, Archie did his job well, and Lady Hudson was well taken to him and treated him very well. He enjoyed his job and felt no desire to try and scheme her out of money or rob her, and for the time, he was enjoying life as an honest working man.
I just think it's odd that he has been in prison numerous times, and he's able to get a job as a butler with such a prominent person.
That is really weird, but again, this is the 1960s, 1970s. I guess before the internet was a thing, I guess they didn't really look very hard. But this new sense of honest living would be interrupted when one day, David Wright, who had recently been paroled, showed up at the gates of Hudson Manor looking for Archie. Now, Archie had written to David and told him about his new job and offered for him to stop by once he was released, and David decided to take him up on it. Now, Lady Hudson was taken with David too, and she actually began offering him room and board in exchange for doing odd jobs around the manor and acting as the gatekeeper. Now, not long after arriving, David allegedly told Archie that he was actually on the run from murdering a man in a public restroom during a sexual encounter. However, these claims were never actually able to be confirmed. David also began to pressure Archie into, quote-unquote, when were they going to make their first move on robbing Lady Hudson. But Archie refused and forbade David from doing the same since he liked his job now. Except one evening, Archie noticed that several pieces of Lady Hudson's jewelry was missing, and he knew immediately David was responsible, and he went to search his room where he found the stolen jewelry hidden in a desk. When Archie confronted David about it and told him to never do it again, David angrily stormed off and drove into town for several hours until nightfall. It's what happens next that would lead to David to become Archie's first victim. So honestly, up to this point, he's a criminal and he's a SOB, but he's not actually killed anyone or physically harmed anyone. He's just a sleazy thief, but that is about to quickly change. So Lady Hudson had gone out to the country for a week and thus left the entire manor in the care of Archie and David, both of whom were alone now. The night of the argument, Archie was lying in bed asleep when he awoke to discover David standing over top of him with a rifle pointed directly at his head. David appeared intoxicated, and when he noticed Archie was awake, he fired, the shot barely missing Archie's head and instead striking the headboard behind him. The two wrestled with the gun, which ended with David smacking Archie in the face with it before finally dropping the gun and passing out in the bed. It was at this point that Archie decided, I'm going to kill him in the morning. The next morning, Archie got up early and made breakfast for a hungover David, who began profusely apologizing for the previous night. Now, Archie waved it off and told him all was forgiven, and then asked him if he would like to go hunting later with him and John Wooten. Remember, John was the first man Archie had a relationship with and the one he stole 100K with. So over the years, they kept in contact, and John was actually going to be stopping by to hang out with Archie. David agreed, and later that day, he, Archie, and John each took a gun from Lady Hudson's collection, Archie arming himself with the same rifle David had used to try and kill him the previous night, and the trio then set out for the Scottish Moors. Now, as they walked through the woods and hunted, Archie would later state that he counted each bullet that David fired to make sure his gun was completely empty before he acted on his plan. So when David told him he was out of bullets, Archie replied, "Good," with a smile before aiming his rifle directly at his head. As David stood frozen in fear, Archie told him, "When I tell you not to steal anything, I mean it. You get drunk and try to kill me, well, look where that pretty face of yours got you now. You've ended up in the Scottish Moors, and this is where you'll die. The only use you ever had was to get fucked." Archie proceeded to shoot David through the head and chest, killing him instantly. Afterwards, he had John help him bury the body in a shallow grave by a small creek, and the pair returned to the manor and acted as if nothing happened. The two would return 2 weeks later to place boulders and rocks over the grave to hide it better, and then John congratulated Archie for committing the perfect murder. And, of course, creating a cover story was pretty easy. That was honestly the easiest part, as Archie simply told Lady Hudson that David had moved on to other jobs, and she accepted it without question. But now, although David was out of the picture, just a few weeks later, Lady Hudson fired Archie and had him escorted from the estate after a friend of hers told her about Archie's criminal past. So see, people do eventually talk. It just takes a lot longer back then than it does today because we didn't, you know, have text message. Now, although Lady Hudson still thought he was an excellent butler, and she actually agreed that she would make no mention of his criminal past should a future employer call her as a reference. So after he was fired from Lady Hudson, Archie split his time between Paris and London, honestly not really sure where to go or what to do at this point, and he actually contemplated suicide for a time, but that idea quickly went out the window because he was such a narcissist. After 6 months of just existing but not really doing anything, Archie saw a new scheme opportunity present itself when he spotted an ad for a very wealthy couple looking for a butler. The couple was Walter and Dorothy Scott Elliott, and they lived in a mansion located in Richmond Court, Chelsea. By this point, Archie had decided that straight and honest life just wasn't for him, and he was going to go back to scheming and stealing to get what he wanted. So in 1977, Archie applied for the job, and he was quickly accepted into the position due to his extensive experience as a butler, which, again, 90% of that experience was made up. And Archie soon moved into the house and began to devise the best way to completely rob them blind and secure himself the biggest fortune he could possibly imagine. Now, the couple took an extreme liking to Archie right away due to his charismatic personality, but especially Dorothy. So, Dorothy actually had a reputation for being pretty short-tempered with the house staff, but for some reason, she really took a liking to Archie, and she would often introduce him as her, quote-unquote, her friend Roy, instead of calling him her butler. And again, side note, Archie is still using the fake name Roy Fontaine at this time throughout all this. So everyone knows him as Roy, but for his real and legal name, it was Archie, and I'm just going to keep calling him Archie to keep it from getting too confusing. So over the next several months, Archie began to devise the best way to get into the Scott Elliott's bedroom in order to get their bank information to empty out their accounts. He began discussing this plan with his former mistress, Mary Coggles, and telling her how he feels that all he needs to do is pull off this last scheme, and he'll be set for the rest of his life. Now, the Scott Elliotts were extremely wealthy, owning several estates and businesses all over Scotland and Britain, and had dozens of bank accounts all over the world. He tells her that his current plan involves renting the flat directly next to the estate and whose roof closely borders the Elliot's roof. From there, he could have someone small and agile sneak over and into the bedroom window to steal the info, obviously meaning he was also looking for a partner in the crime, since it would be too suspicious if he did it himself. So as they were going over the plan, Mary actually suggested a friend of hers who may be willing to help Archie, a man named Michael Kiddo. So the trio met at a pub close to Walter and Dorothy's and began discussing the plan and other possible schemes. Michael was fascinated with Archie's life of crime and his vast knowledge of stealing and getting away with it. Michael agreed to help Archie that day and asked if they could possibly take a tour of the couple's place in order to get a better layout of everything. So Archie actually agreed and stated that they could actually tour it the same evening as Dorothy was having some health problems and had to spend several days in a nursing home for evaluation. Walter, on the other hand, was in his 80s and had trouble sleeping, so each night he would dose himself up with sleeping pills, and from that point on, it was literally nearly impossible to wake him. So as night fell, Archie took Mary and Michael to the Elliots to look around. The trio walked around the house, checking each room one by one, and finally got to the master bedroom where all the bank records were kept. But just as they were about to open the door, it suddenly swung open, and standing in the doorway was Dorothy, who had come home early from the nursing home. She demanded to know why Archie was there at such a late hour and why he had strangers with him. So without saying a word and panicking, both Archie and Michael pounced on Dorothy. Michael wrapped his hand around her mouth to keep her from screaming as Archie ran into the bedroom and grabbed a pillow off the bed and placed it over Dorothy's face, slowly suffocating her to death. Now, this deeply upset Archie, not because he cared about her or anything, but because he saw his whole grand scheme being ruined right before his eyes, because now they have a dead body to deal with. But as they were figuring out what to do with Dorothy, they also had another problem. Walter was asleep in the bed, just feet away from his wife's murdered body, and he was starting to stir awake. Thinking fast, Archie and Michael actually picked Dorothy's body up and placed it back in the bed just as Walter started to come to and asked what was Archie doing there. Archie responded that Dorothy was having trouble sleeping and had actually called him to the house to get her medicine, but that she was finally back to sleep now and all was good. So in his confused state from all the sleeping pills he had taken, Walter didn't question this and proceeded to go back to sleep beside his dead wife. The next day, Walter awoke early as he was traveling to a country club for the day and he left the house without trying to wake his wife. With Walter out of the house, Archie, Mary, and Michael snuck back in and tried to figure out what to do. Archie called up his good friend John Wooten to come help dispose of the body like he did with David. They wrapped Dorothy in a silk sheet before stuffing her into the trunk of John's car once he arrived. After that, they raided Dorothy's closet and Mary proceeded to put on one of her outfits and one of her wigs and disguised herself as Dorothy as the group of criminals then drove around town to various banks, draining as much money as they could from the Elliott's bank accounts, with of course Mary acting as Dorothy to withdraw the money. But they still had the issue of Walter, who would eventually notice his wife was missing, so they had to come up with a new plan. And of course, this is back in like the 60s, 70s, where I guess they didn't question it much. If you vaguely resembled the license or photo ID you gave them, they're just like, yeah, here you go. You want $1,000 from your account? Have at it. So that evening, Walter returned home from the country club, and waiting for him was Archie with a glass of whiskey that he just also happened to crush up several sleeping pills into. After Walter finished the glass, Archie informed him that Dorothy was wanting to go visit friends in Scotland and that she was waiting for him in the car. Walter agreed to go and climbed into the back of the car and was greeted by Dorothy, or at least someone he thought was Dorothy. Mary was still dressed in her clothing and wig and continued to pretend to be Dorothy, and in his confused state, Walter fully believed that she was. I should also mention at this point that, yes, Walter is in his 80s at this point. However, Dorothy was only in her late 50s, so she was much closer in age to Mary and Archie, and that kind of explains why she was able to pass as Mary.
I was wondering that myself because I thought, he's in his 80s. Is this like an old woman? But, no, okay, yeah. That explains things.
Much younger woman, so it does kind of give credence to like how they got away with it. If she got her wig on, if she's kind of hiding her face behind this big-ass fur coat. So John and Michael were also in the car, acting as drivers for the Elliots, and the group drove to one of the couple's cabins in the Scotland countryside. Archie, Michael, and John left Mary and Walter at the cabin while they drove back to the house and ransacked it for any valuables. The group stopped along a deserted road and buried Dorothy's body off to the side in a shallow grave before continuing on to the house. Now, after they were satisfied, they drove back, and Walter was still none the wiser that it wasn't his wife that he was sitting beside. However, the effects of the drugs were starting to wear off, and Archie knew that they couldn't keep him drugged forever, and they decided the only thing to do was to kill him. As the group started to drive back to the house the following day, Walter asked to stop the car so he could pee behind a tree off the road. As he walked away, Archie decided now was as good of a time as any to strike. He got out of the car, snuck up behind Walter, and attempted to strangle him from behind with a scarf. However, Archie underestimated how strong Walter was, even for a man in his 80s, who began to fight back and overpower him. Archie ordered Michael to help him by retrieving a shovel from the trunk of the car. Michael brought the shovel to Archie, who then proceeded to repeatedly bash Walter in the head with it to the point that his skull was completely crushed. After they were sure he was dead, the two men buried Walter's body in a shallow grave close by. So now free of both Scott Elliots, a squad of criminals felt a sigh of relief and decided to hang around the cabin for a few days, just drinking and basking in their stolen wealth. Archie, Michael, and John made frequent trips back to London in order to ransack the house for any leftover valuables they may have missed the first time, and while they were gone, Mary was left at the cabin alone just to do what she wanted, and she decided that she wanted to flaunt off her new wealth, which included walking around the nearby town dressed in Dorothy's jewels and fur coats and making frequent calls to her friends back home about all the nice things she now had. So now we have a blabbermouth to have to deal with. Of course, when he found out about this, Archie warned her that she needed to keep a low profile and to stop talking to her friends or else she risked getting them all caught. He demanded that she get rid of the fur coat since it could lead back to Dorothy, but she protested and wanted to keep it. Now, Archie gave her several more chances over the next few days as they relaxed around the cabin, but upon learning that she disobeyed his orders again and was seen around town flaunting the fur coat again, he made up his mind that she had become a liability and that she needed to die. So one night, Mary attempted to seduce Archie by asking him to have sex with her on top of the fur coat laid out in front of the fireplace. The two did have sex several times before Archie demanded that she throw the coat into the fireplace to destroy it. She again protested and refused, and in response, Archie grabbed the fireplace poker and began to beat her over the head with it, which knocked her unconscious. Checking her pulse, he found that she was still alive and proceeded to wrap a plastic bag around her head and left her laying on the floor to slowly suffocate while he and Michael enjoyed a glass of whiskey in the next room. So about 10 minutes later, he came back to check on her and found that she was dead. Later, he would tell police that he actually did feel a bit guilty about having to kill Mary since he had been friends with her for over a decade at this point, but he knew she was a liability if she was kept alive. So that's another weird thing too. He's like, I feel bad, but again, if she kept blabbing, she would have got me caught. So he just decided to casually bash her in the head with a fireplace poker before just putting a bag over her head and just letting her slowly suffocate on her own.
After they had sex.
After they had sex. That shows you how much of a pig he was too. He's like, I'll have sex with you first and then I'm just going to kill you. So Archie and Michael dressed Mary's body in male clothing and cut most of her hair off as they wanted to make it look like a quote-unquote lesbian murder, which would have kept police from looking too hard for a killer, which, sad and disturbing as that may be, it was true. They loaded her into the trunk of John's car and drove back to Scotland in order to look for a place to bury her, and also just John Wooten for a moment. He doesn't have any direct involvement in actually, like, murdering anyone, but it's just so weird. He's casually, like, hanging around. He's like, yeah, you can use my car to haul off all the dead bodies you guys use. That's no big deal. So I guess everyone needs a friend like John. So after failing to find a place to bury Mary, the two decided to just dump her body in a nearby stream and leave it. So with Mary out of the picture, the last three members of the criminal squad returned to London and set about their futures as they believed their troubles were finally behind them. John returned to his home in Lytham, while Michael set out to continue to try and perfect his thieving skills in order to quote-unquote be the best criminal there ever was. Archie, on the other hand, was ready to give up his life of crime after murdering four people. All he wanted was to have enough money to fly somewhere nice and retire in luxury. No more stealing, no more murders, just a life of relaxation. So yeah, I murdered four people, I stole all this stuff from these poor elderly people. It's time to finally put me first and retire.
It's time for my reward.
However, before he could get his reward, and just as Archie was planning his retirement, a new issue would arise, and he would end up murdering his fifth and final victim not long after, in the form of his own brother. So shortly before Christmas 1977, Archie's younger half-brother Donald Hall was released from prison following a 3-year stint for burglary, and he set out to track down Archie as he wanted to become a better criminal. Also, all these people that want to perfect their criminal skills and are seeking Archie out as like this master teacher, even though he did like 15 years in prison.
It's like One Piece. They want to become the Pirate King.
Literally, they want to become the Pirate King, and they're looking at probably one of the worst people to do it because he was in jail for nearly 2 decades. So Donald was actually able to track down John Wooten, who then called Archie to come get his brother since the two did not get along. However, if Donald was expecting a warm welcome, he was very mistaken, as Archie absolutely despised his brother. He would later tell police, "Dirt under his fingernails, unshaven, I hated even having my half-brother near me."
I wonder if his half-brother did not realize this.
Probably not. And then we're literally about to learn here in a second that his half-brother was a very shitty human being, so I don't think he had a lot of self-awareness. So the biggest reason for this hatred was because Donald was also a convicted child molester. And Archie despised pedophiles, which is like his only redeeming quality. He saw his brother as a pervert who was better off dead, and he knew that he could potentially, and he knew that if Donald stuck around or did any snooping, he could potentially discover information about the murder, and so he invited his brother to come stay with him, fully intending on murdering him. So the very same day that Donald arrived at the flat where Archie was staying, Archie invited Michael Kiddo to come hang out as well, but in actuality, he was also in on the plan to kill Donald. Archie asked Donald if he wanted to learn some tricks of the trade to become a better criminal, and one of those tricks was how to tie up any victims so they didn't escape while you were robbing them. Donald agreed to be tied up by Archie, and after doing so, Archie went into the bathroom and soaked a rag in chloroform, because again, where do they get all this chloroform from? Archie and Michael forced Donald's head into the rag until he was rendered unconscious, and then the two men carried his body into the bathroom where they had filled up the tub with hot water. Archie held his brother's head under the water for over 5 minutes until he was sure he was dead. Afterwards, leaving his body in the hot water in order to offset rigor mortis and make it harder to determine a time of death. So by this point, Archie has seemingly committed 5 perfect murders and gone away with each one. All that was left to do now was dispose of his final victim's body, and he would finally be ready to retire in peace. And that's another thing, too, with this whole case. Is like, this whole time, Archie has, like, this dream board. Like, I just want to retire to this nice place. And so it's so weird. He's like, I just have to kill this person and then kill this person, and then I can finally retire. Like, murdering people's not what I want to do. I just want to be able to retire with other people's money, and the only thing standing in the way of me and that person's money is that person. So the only rational thing to do is just murder them. So the very next day, Archie and Michael loaded Donald's body into the trunk of a car and once again began to drive around to look for a good spot to dispose of their victim. However, before they left, Archie made Michael do something that would spell the beginning of the end for him. So Archie was surprisingly a very superstitious person, and he very much believed that this is one reason that he had yet to be caught. The car the two were using to dispose of Donald's body had a license plate number which had 3 9s in it, and Archie saw this as being extremely unlucky, and so he actually had Michael replace it with a fake license plate. So as the two drove around looking for a good burial site, they soon found themselves caught in an intense snowstorm that prevented them from finding any ground that wasn't frozen. The two decided to stop for the night at a nearby hotel and continue the search for a burial site in the morning, So they stopped off at the Blenheim House Hotel and checked into a room, leaving Donald's body in the trunk of the car. So this is the point where Archie's luck seemed to run out, as the manager of the hotel, Norman Wright, would later be described by police as suspicious by nature, and he did not like the look of Michael or Archie at all, and he was suspicious of them from the minute he laid eyes on them, which if he was suspicious before, once all this comes out, I'm sure he's double suspicious. Like, I literally like clocked a serial killer the minute I saw him.
I got you.
So he is going to be bragging about that, I'm sure, till the end of his days. So wanting to be sure, Norman actually phoned police and asked them to run the license plate of the car Michael and Archie had arrived in, and upon doing so, found that the license plate belonged to a completely different type of car than the one Norman described over the phone. So two officers were dispatched to the hotel to check it out, and upon confirming that the wrong plates were on the car, they asked Archie and Michael to come down to the station with them to answer a few questions. So arriving down at the station, Archie asked if he could use the bathroom before questioning, and he was allowed to go in, alone, at which point he escaped out of the bathroom window and was now officially on the run. Police decided that they should check the car at this point, and that's when they discovered Donald's body in the trunk, and a citywide manhunt officially began for Archibald Hall. So Archie actually managed to evade several police cars before flagging down a taxi in an attempt to escape to Dunbar, but as he was attempting to leave the city, the taxi was stopped at a roadblock, and Archie was quickly arrested attempting to flee. But Archie wasn't done. After being taken back to the police station, he asked for a glass of water in his prison cell, and at that point, after being left alone for a brief moment, he retrieved a large bag of pills he had hidden in his rectum and proceeded to swallow all of them in an attempt to commit suicide.
He was ready.
He had a plan which involved God knows how many prescription pills shoved up his ass, where he got those, and if he already had them on him because he had the forethought to do that. We will never know. That is lost to time. But this man was ready and willing to end it all. So after trying to commit suicide, Archie awoke several hours later in the hospital, and it was at this point he realized that his run had come to an end, and there was no escaping at this point. So he was finally captured and finally questioned by police, but honestly it didn't really matter considering Michael had been held in question this entire time, and he sang like a canary, telling police everything about Donald's murder, about the murders of the Walter and Dorothy Scott Elliott and Mary's murder, as well as where they dumped all their bodies. So by this point, police had actually found Mary's body about a month earlier, but had yet to make a positive match as to who it was, and an investigation was ongoing with the disappearance of the Scott Elliotts. So again, they were investigating all these, but they had no way to connect them to Archie at that point. So with this new info, police finally knew where to find them. On July 18th, 1978, Archibald Hall confessed to everything and agreed to show police exactly where he'd buried Walter and Dorothy, and even confessed to David's murder, which up to that point, police had no idea he was even missing, let alone dead. And both Michael and Archie were charged with first-degree murder. So during the trials, both pointed the finger at the other one, obviously as being the mastermind and the one solely responsible for all of the murders. Several doctors diagnosed Archie as being a full-blown psychopath and narcissist. At the end of their trials, Archibald Hall was found guilty of 4 counts of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Now, the murder charge for Dorothy Scott was left open due to prosecutors unsure of whether Archie or Michael was the one who actually killed her. Michael Kiddo was also found guilty of 3 counts of first-degree murder and also sentenced to life in prison. He attempted to lessen his sentence by implicating John Wooten, but due to a lack of evidence, investigators were unable to charge him with anything. Archie began serving his sentence at Hull Prison and made several suicide attempts over the years, all of which failed, and eventually he accepted his fate, and he decided to write an autobiography. So Archibald Hall published his memoir, A Perfect Gentleman, in 1999, and in it, not only did he confess to all the details of his 5 murders, he even left the reader with this: to any criminal out there who thinks they might have the capacity for murder, to anyone similar to myself, think again. In the final analysis, my life is an impoverished nightmare. Let me be a lesson to you. Archibald Hall would pass away from a stroke on September 16, 2002, at the age of 78, becoming one of the oldest inmates in Britain at the time to be serving a life sentence. And that is the case of Archibald Hall, aka the Bloody Butler. And that's the thing, too. It's interesting because at the very end, unlike most serial killers, he actually was like, yeah, I admit to all this and let me be a lesson to you. Don't murder people. My life is horrible. My life is horrible and ruined because of this, and I ruined all these lives. And so it's weird to see that point of view where he's like, yeah, don't become a serial killer.
Yeah, it's crazy he even admitted to everything. Most don't.
Most don't admit to all of it, especially like David's murder. Like, police had even no idea David was even missing. So the fact that he did confess to that, and also just the fact that, like, he could have been an honest man. He had the skills, the personality for it, and just the fact that he decided to use it for evil.
I mean, he was working for, like, very wealthy people that held him in high esteem. He was living in mansions.
And that's the thing, too. And they were paying him well. So it's not like they were, like, and also they weren't, like, kicking him when he was down. They weren't treating him poorly because he was the staff. All his employers, like, we treated him like family. Like, he was very well respected by us. We treated him good. He was a part of this household. And so he was so much more lucky and fortunate than so many people back during that time. And he decided to just be like, I don't care for this. I just want to murder people and steal stuff. And so it's just one of those senseless cases. This guy was a complete idiot. But he's dead now. So, and with that, thank you guys again so much for tuning in for another episode. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or Spotify. Helps us out a lot, helps other people discover the podcast, and we just love hearing your guys' feedback. If you want to see photos from this case, you can follow us on Instagram at Beers with Queers Pod, that's P-O-D, or on Facebook at Beers with Queers, a true crime podcast. And until Monday, stay dangerous out there, my friend.
See you soon.
Bye.